Monday, February 25th, LA podcast. Everyone is healthy.
Breakfast Club.
We had breakfast today.
Yeah.
I got some home state breakfast tacos. I got the wrong kind. I got the all corn instead of flour.
We had our biggest ever podcast disagreement, much worse than the Cherokee and Nueva one about corn versus
you
flour.
You like the corn ones more. I think it depends on the place. And at home state, they really don't even, I don't even know why they offer it. They don't want you to get it. Maybe it's gluten-free or something.
I can't think of a single scenario in which I would prefer flour tacos.
I think it's the Texas way, though. That is the Texas part.
Oh, I don't care about Texas. I don't care about Texas at all.
I got to try the new Crosswalk.
Oh, yeah.
That's how you really know you've made it as a business, where you have created an environment so dangerous that people are dying to eat your tacos, getting mowed down by cars. And so the Crosswalk is beautiful.
It's a nice one.
And it goes
got a little
right
center,
to their
center
door.
Median. Yeah.
Oh, it's so nice. Yeah. A little island where you can just take a break.
Yeah.
Any stories, any fun stories before we get into the news?
We have
some fun news this week as well.
I have a story.
Oh, great.
My story is all about the fact that I am now the number one transit rider.
I'm so glad you mentioned this.
On Sunset Boulevard. I own Sunset Boulevard. I have staked a claim that I think is untouchable. I spent several weeks behind an anonymous individual.
Let me explain. I'm sure everyone knows what you're talking about.
You have to tell at least the app.
Was a high
King
schooler.
Of Sunset Boulevard.
Tell them about the app, first of all, because I don't even know if we've talked about it. You have to get into this.
So there's an app called Transit App that...
it's just called Transit. If you are just going to find it in the App Store, which I recommend, it's just called Transit.
Yeah, so arrival predictions for all kinds of transit agencies, including
tells you when to leave. You set up your trip and it says leave now,
including LA Metro, which famously has very terrible arrival predictions because they only update them every 3 minutes or whatever, something that I think that they're working on. But anyway, one of the features of Transit, this app, is that they if you are on the bus, you can share your location with the app, thereby giving the real-time location of the bus that you're on and making the arrival predictions useful to other people. So in order to get people to do that, they've kind of gamified riding the bus, and they'll give you like a...
Fake points,
total like Chuck E. Cheese ticket numbers.
For Chuck E. Cheese tickets, you get something.
It reminds me of...
Much less valuable than a Chuck E. Cheese
ticket.
So
you're like the mayor. What was that app that was like...
Foursquare.
Like you're like the mayor of the
of
two
Sunset
bus.
Sunset Boulevard.
Or Sunset, the whole route, like all buses, two,
two.
Four,
it's,
and
no, just
the two. Okay.
But I want it to be
congratulations.
Sunset. Thank you. I have helped thousands of people get where they're going.
Yeah, because each point is one person that used your information, that you helped.
That is what they say.
It's really great. I took a ride on the 704 from Beverly Hills to Echo Park last week and got like 800 points from that alone.
Yeah.
Rush hour is like really when you can get points.
Yeah, you get Boku. I don't know. It's crazy. The numbers I'm putting up right now. I'm at the top of my game, really.
You can't feel your face. Quick story. I went up to Switzer Falls. Have you guys ever?
Wow. What day?
There. It was the sunny day. It was the day after it snowed. And I had kind of forgotten. Like, I wasn't going up there to see snow, but I did see a lot. I put some in the thermos.
It in your fridge
just to hang
for
on
later.
To it. Yep.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was real. I mean, it's amazing how quickly you get out of the city and it feels like Northern California or like the Pacific Northwest, basically. I've been there a bunch of times, but it's always shockingly close. And it's so fun. It's such a nice little hike.
I always feel that way when I go up to Altadena.
Yeah.
Just like, it doesn't feel like you're in LA or Southern California anymore.
But the roads are dangerous getting up to.
Well, they used to have a shuttle in the summer that from the Gold Line to the Switzer Falls trailhead.
Have you done that?
Okay. But I can see why they don't now, because it was like 40 degrees. Right.
But I don't even know if they made it permanent. I think it was like a pilot program. But that's how there's the parking situation up there is horrible in the summer. So
when
shuttle is the best.
Go.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great idea.
But now is a fun time because the stream that runs through the whole trail is running really hot.
Roaring.
Yes. And you have to cross in like very precarious way. It's not really built for safety at all. And I fell in a bunch of times. Alyssa.
Yes.
You had a sort of a banner week.
Did I?
In your other job.
Oh, my actual job.
Yes. But any stories?
I also just want to talk about the snow. I know we're probably going to discuss it, you know, as part of this week's news, but what a treat.
Yeah, really nice.
It was.
Did either of you actually see any come out of the sky?
No, I tried.
Either. I did in Utah.
Oh, right.
Mm.
A lot of unhappy faces.
I can't believe you left and missed it. No, it was just it's one of those things where you always forget that weather gets people so excited if we have it. And, we were all starting the day knowing that the predictions and the models were going to possibly bring this low, you know, snow line, and just the like hysteria on Twitter and watching the reports come in and trying to confirm them. 'Cause the people who confirm snowfall events are weather spotters who like work for the National Weather Service, or they're usually like volunteers, but they're like trained
like
people.
Like in Twister.
Yeah, exactly.
But for snow.
So they have to, these people all over the city have to actually be confirming that they saw what was snow and what was not graupel.
Yes.
Which I want to discuss
heavily. When we woke up that morning, nobody knew what that was. No one had ever heard this word before.
I want to talk just for the whole hour about
graupel. Is it graupel or grapple?
I don't know. I just want to say it that way.
Graupel.
I think graupel just doesn't sound as exciting as graupel. Yeah. So I don't even know the origin.
It's not an exciting concept.
No, not at all. I don't know why they just don't call it like ball snow or something. Right. Like that is really actually what it is.
It's when the snowflakes collect like in the sky.
They get coated in ice, basically. So it's like a snowflake that's coated in ice, which sounds delicious. But that's mostly what fell in most places. Yeah. And that's not very unusual. But the people I talked to for a story who confirmed with some of the weather spotters, some of our local climate scientists, including Daniel Swain, who is Weather West on Twitter, who is one of my favorite weather follows. He says he believes that we saw snow at very low elevations, 1,000 feet, and sometimes less, because a JPL scientist I spoke with Brian Kahn, said there were miniature thunderstorms in the sky that were so cold they were pushing the snow flurries even lower down.
Wow. It kind of looked like that.
Yes,
there were these little
were
spots on the skyline that looked like really nasty thunderstorms.
So those were like, it was a very different kind of storm. It came from the north. It was dry. It wasn't a wet, like Pacific atmospheric river storm, which is what we usually get in the winter. So we had this very magical thing. And if we had just not destroyed our climate, it probably would have snowed more.
It seems like it used to happen a lot more often.
Yeah.
I was happy to see Jerry O'Connell back on the news as basically a snow spotter.
He had a great video. It was shown very clearly the flake formation.
Yeah,
so
he's still got
he can be an official weather spotter in Calabasas.
You were correcting a lot of people's snow hysteria. You were sort of being a Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Don't call me that. Don't call me that.
Just in the way that he's like annoying and correcting people
online.
I
will own that part. Yeah. I just think people love to, again, write about LA not knowing anything about the size, elevation, topography of our area. So
a lot of people saying like, oh, it hasn't snowed in LA since
I heard
like 1964.
Yeah, I heard 64. Like, I heard.
But that was downtown, which it did not.
Yeah, 62, there were flurries spotted or, you know, a dusting downtown. And then everybody said it hadn't snowed for 7 years, which is also not true because the valley got tons of snow in 89. So a real snow. So they're
snows in LA County every year.
Yes, because we have tall mountains in LA County.
But this was still very
It was still very, you know, who knows what usual means anymore, but it was rare and exciting and won't happen as much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Unless this is the start of like a day after tomorrow.
No, but that's the one thing I wanted to know about specifically. Like, are we going to see this wide swing? Because you do hear about these blizzards that are caused by climate change. And the climate scientist and meteorologist said no, because LA is not a place that can happen. We don't have enough moisture to like make it be, you know, one of these apocalyptic snowstorms. We can have a drought that lasts for 5 years.
Yeah. Or 50.
Or a wildfire. Yeah. So don't worry about the blizzard.
Day after tomorrow scenario is off the table. Alyssa's scenario
is 120 degrees for like 3 weeks at a time.
God, that's depressing.
We have a lot of Walker content that we have to get through this week. Do you want to talk about what you're doing tonight? You're doing something exciting.
Yes, there is a big bike ride to the Oscars with some people who are attending on bike, riding their like formal wear on bikes. So there'll be this, I think, a caravan of people arriving who will then attend the awards. Some people who are, I don't know if there's anyone who's actually nominated this year that's going.
Your daughter's not nominated. Are you worried that she'll
be next year,
that she'll get discovered? She's very performative.
She is.
I mean, that's the only reason that, you know, I would get her near Hollywood people is for that reason. But it should be good. Watch for, I don't know what the actual hashtag is, but there's like an Oscar ride group that's going to be.
It's going to be on your feed.
Yeah. Well, I think they'll probably get like coverage from the news media who are always like, these people.
Right. I'm glad that we just shamed every person nominated for an Oscar, because apparently none of them.
Not that I know. I don't want to say. I don't know. But this is your chance. You could still, you know, next year, once you get that nomination locked.
Yeah. Contact
start
Alyssa.
Planning that. Or you could walk there.
Yeah.
You don't have to ride a bike.
And
you
also
take the train there.
Wrote an article. So Hollywood and Highland and that whole area has, of course, been shut down like all week.
For a week. Some parts of Hollywood will be closed for a total of 10 days to cars.
And I saw an article show up in my feed that said, keep Hollywood Boulevard shut down to cars all year round. And I said, I don't even have to click this. I know exactly I know exactly what it says. But that this is a drum you've been banging for a while.
It makes no sense that area should not have any cars in it ever. For a variety of reasons that I'm sure are obvious to the people who listen to this podcast. But it is closed
all the time
for, you know, movies you may have heard of, like the Captain Marvel movie that's coming out.
That's right.
It's gonna
I am
be
trying
closed.
To get the word out about that.
That's going to be a 3-day closure. That's going to be not too long after the Oscars. It's closed for premieres or events, major events like that, around 3 times a month. And the thing about the premieres, once I started to go back, you used to think it was like a night for a premiere, but it's more like the Star Wars level, the Captain Marvel level, where they build things or land an X-Wing on
Hollywood
Boulevard.
Rogue One, I think, was there for a little
while.
So
there's all sorts of spectacles that are closing the streets. And my argument is that we're so used to that already. It's obviously not ended the world already. Mm-hmm. So we should just keep it closed all the time. There are also so many different things that have happened in the last year. Things like micromobility. There are scooters everywhere in Hollywood now. If you go hang out there are tourists riding scooters on the sidewalk who would probably ride them in the street if they felt safer. There's street vending issues because there's people who are claiming that the street vendors are clogging up the sidewalks and making people walk in the street, but actually shouldn't we just make the sidewalks bigger?
Yeah, no, this is, I think, something that is really interesting. There are few places in LA, probably nowhere in LA or Southern California, where the pedestrian volumes are as high as they are on Hollywood Boulevard, you know, for whatever reason.
We don't know why they go there, but they go there.
But I go to Ripley's, believe it or not, to relax. Scott and I used to record there.
Yes. within spitting distance of the pig and whistle. Yes. So, and people were spitting. And so, but yeah, so basically we have this is one of the places where you can reasonably say it's not safe to have people riding scooters on the sidewalk. It's not safe to have like the volume of pedestrians we have. And the LA response has typically been like, well, what are all these people doing walking here? They shouldn't be here.
On a place that's called the Walk of Fame.
Right. and really like Alyssa, you're saying like the much more acceptable solution is to make it more friendly and accessible to people. Like the volumes of foot traffic that there are there, that's something that we're trying to cultivate other places. And here we already have it. Like, let's just actually facilitate people being on foot or being on bike or whatever. And nobody likes driving on Hollywood Boulevard.
No,
anyway.
They already avoid it. If people who live nearby already avoid it.
Crazy to choose to drive down Hollywood Boulevard. It doesn't make sense. Just like, you know, get rid of the cars there.
What are your priorities for car banning? Like specific streets and look, is that number one, that part of Hollywood Boulevard?
I mean, I think Scott's point is good. It's the volumes are there, you, as evidenced by the scramble crosswalks that LADOT put in at both Hollywood Vine and Hollywood and Highland. They only put those in places where they already know that a lot of people will need to be crossing diagonally.
Yep.
I just think it would solve a lot of problems at once and be the first good test case, like you say, to start doing this in other places. And I also think that it would be another good place to test just a different kind of not a streetcar, but like some kind of micro transit type situation that could be circulating along Hollywood Boulevard to let people get from one side to another.
So how much is Rick Caruso paying? That's what I want to know.
This is my question. So say in like downtown, that's another place obviously where we should probably ban cars pretty soon. Why would a streetcar not make sense in downtown once cars were banned? Like a lot of the blocks are pretty long. If you're getting from like Staples to Grand Park or something, it's like not.
I'm not against a streetcar. I would vote for a streetcar that would be completed before 2075.
Right. That's right. It doesn't seem
so.
Like
I just think it'd be cool if you were going to close it to cars. The argument would be that people wouldn't be able to go long distances if they weren't in a vehicle. Of course, they could go on a street a block away, but it would be cool to have some kind of hop on, hop off free type circulator type vehicle.
Like the dash buses. I mean, they already exist. I don't understand.
Just to serve Hollywood Boulevard, though, I'm saying like a ride.
I don't understand the downtown streetcar because it is, if we are talking about a scenario in which there are no cars in downtown, then the existing transit options would work much better.
So great, yeah.
And it's kind of solving a problem that no longer really exists, especially considering the plan is the one way piece of shit that they have.
Yeah, it's not that we don't like a cute little trolley going around downtown. It's just that.
Yeah.
I remember something you did, it was like years ago, for Good website?
Good, maybe. Good Magazine.
Good Magazine?
Maybe.
About different plans for like gondolas and funiculars downtown if they banned cars. You don't.
I mean
5,000. I'm like,
I probably just made that up.
Yeah.
No, I think you have to think of all different ways to get people around. And you go to these cities, like I think I probably had just been to like Switzerland when I wrote that. Because you go to Zurich and your transit pass gets you rides on funiculars, rides on like inclinators, rides on gondolas. You get all these different appropriate transit options based on where you are.
My priorities for closing, I do think Hollywood Boulevard is first. I think we should like make it as long a stretch of Hollywood as possible. I've said online before, I think building off of what you wrote, Alyssa, just take the entire part of Hollywood that goes from Sunset Boulevard to La Brea, basically, and just close it to cars.
All the way there.
Yeah. Wow. Why not? Like,
it
makes an enormous mess where it meets up with Sunset and Hillhurst. Like that intersection
like five,
is
five 5 branch intersection.
That's true.
Which is the worst.
Intersection is a nightmare.
But there are stretches of Hollywood in that portion that you're talking about that are super underdeveloped, where there's like basically no foot traffic. That would help solve that problem potentially.
And then you've also created a de facto bike route through a very dense neighborhood. Even if it is, even if it is less concentrated than Central Hollywood, East Hollywood is actually denser in terms of.
And there's no good way to get through there on a bike.
Certainly, that stretch where the new crosswalk is in Homestead is from Vermont
to
Hillhurst. Absolutely,
start right there.
Should be blocked off
with that. But then, would you have cars being allowed to travel from north to south? Because this is what I got yelled at online about. They were like, how am I supposed to go around that? And I was like, we could put lights in and you could drive through.
For Ciclovia. Cars can get through.
We would let you through like you've let pedestrians go through.
Like, yes.
If they've figured this out on Broadway in Manhattan, yes. I think that it can be managed.
That's a good example.
Here.
I mean, we should look at Broadway in New York City as the same length. You know, that it's not just Times Square where they've done it with Broadway. It's gone, you know, much farther south. So that's a really good. We should compare it to scale.
Yeah, and beyond that, I would say 7th in downtown.
Yep.
One of the ones I always say is Colorado and in Santa Monica, parallel to the Expo line.
Well, let's do Colorado and Pasadena too.
Yeah,
all
sure.
Colorado.
That actually would be great. Yes, all the Colorado.
Yeah, all the Colorados.
We have to move on to the next piece of Walker content. Alyssa, you had an article. This one came out like 2 weeks ago about multi-generational home sharing. You talked to a woman named Kate. Kate's in her 50s. Mm-hmm. She was having a little trouble affording her apartment, living by herself.
Yes.
And so she was looking for potentially kind of a roommate arrangement. And there's another woman named Laurette who was in her late 90s who was living in a house or like a larger apartment.
Yeah, she had bought a house, you know, back when people could afford to buy houses in Culver City. And it wasn't where, you know, it wasn't, she hasn't owned it. So I think it's not like she bought it like decades and decades ago, but it was long enough ago that the house has really increased in a lot of value.
Yeah.
Cause I didn't even, when I looked at the numbers for Culver City, I was shocked to see how much the home values have gone up and how little has been added to the Culver City housing stock over the last few years.
In 2016, you have in the article, they built 11 units.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's both homes and, you know, apartments.
Units.
Yeah. Units.
That's a smallish building.
That's like, you know, not very much. So it was interesting to speak to both of these women, one of them who both wanted to stay in Culver City, who loved Culver City, who had ties there, who had friends there. And when you get to be getting older, it's harder to drive or, you know, you want to be able to have these transit options and you want to be able to have your family too nearby, which I think was, you know, they didn't want to have to relocate to places where they didn't have this support network. So I learned about this nonprofit called Affordable Living for the Aging. They've been around since the 70s and they've been doing these matches where they find older homeowners who want to stay in their homes and match them with other people who I think they're all older adults. They don't have to be, you know, the same, you know, age of, you know, retired. They can be there. Most of them are still working, independent people.
So it's not like millennials.
No, I mean,
it's mostly
it's focused on
people in
aging.
Their 50s and 60s
other,
being paired with people
exactly.
Older than that. Yes. Okay.
There's other nonprofits that do. This was a whole series on CURB. So there's other nonprofits that do matching specifically with like students and seniors, which is pretty cool. But I think the focus here was this was started because people who are getting older are often on fixed incomes. And even that can affect your mortgage payment as you get older because you've been locked into this mortgage payment and then you stop working and you still want to be able to afford your home. Or you're in a situation like Kate was in the story where she just wanted to stay where she was and she couldn't find another apartment that was affordable to her in any way. Still working, but, you know, wants to start aging in place and you can't stay in your place. So this nonprofit is so great. And I should say, too, you know, people move in together and have roommates for all sorts of different reasons. It's not, it's also like a very American thing not to live with your family, you know, other members of your family, who are older and younger than you. But I think what makes this program so powerful is that they've been getting these homeowners who are largely wealthier and living on the west side of LA, where there are a lot more single family homes, and showing them how this can be a great situation for them, to have somebody else who's living there for companionship, for some, you know, light chores, and just making sure for their families that they have someone around, which a lot of the families can't live, afford to live closer. The kids can't afford to live close enough to their parents. So to have someone around is great.
The pairing that you talk about in the article is so heartwarming.
They're adorable.
They hang out all the time. And I was surprised. So the home sharers, I guess, pay an average of $600 a month, which in a place like Culver City is incredible.
Unheard of, yeah.
Especially for like sharing a house, basically.
A beautiful house.
But it is kind of, I think it's like fantastic for the people in their 80s and 90s that like need companionship and stuff. There is something kind of dystopian about these people entering their 50s and 60s who can no longer, their rents are rising, they can't afford to stay in the place they've lived their entire lives. And the option is either move out of the city entirely or move in with someone who's like 80 or 90 years old and like provide companionship for them. Like, I think if it works, it's great. But the ideal situation would be that they could just stay in the apartment where they want to
live.
Or
that someone would have built them something that they could, or built, or, you know, converted something. And that's why a part of, I think, why you wanted to talk about this, that's so exciting. And kind of, I tried to address that in the article, but then there was this amazing like bombshell announcement from AARP this week. I don't know if you want to talk about that, Scott, which is super exciting.
That the AARP actually came out and said that they were supporting the SB 50 More Homes Act. We've discussed on this podcast before, basically the successor to SB 829.
827. Unbelievable.
Wow, you've already forgotten.
You forget that. That was the most important number in our lives for seemingly a year.
50 is so much easier to remember.
I think you guys just don't understand how many of these bills I look at. It's the numbers just rattling around in my brain. SB 827. Yes, you're right. So this is the follow-up to SB 827 that is intending to make it easier to actually develop apartment buildings in larger parts of the urban centers of California, where mostly apartments are illegal.
Like both in, written by LA podcast guest Scott Wiener, SB 827 was the more like sweeping, less compassionate version of it, where they were just going to build everywhere, like sort of indiscriminately in a city as long as it was near transit lines. Now, lower income more vulnerable neighborhoods are protected from new buildings potentially. And the focus that this is what I really like about it. It's more about job centers rather than just transit lines. So rich neighborhoods like Pacific Palisades and like Malibu
or Culver City
or Culver City. Well, Culver City at least has some transit going
through
there.
Yeah, they have a transit.
But neighborhoods that have fought transit are not rewarded by not having to build as much housing. So I think SB 50 is a huge improvement.
I agree.
On 827.
It will be interesting to see how that, so the AARP, of course, is the largest organization with membership among the retiree population.
Yeah.
And in just
it's like the largest
50,
organization, period.
It's huge. It's enormous. Tens of millions of members. And AARP in California, at least, has been extremely active in looking at the way in which California's built environment and the kind of things that we're talking about, the system that we've put in place where people can't really afford to do anything except remain in place, is possibly lining up to have, it's currently having very negative impacts on also older incumbent Californians. They've been active in trying to figure out how we can get a transportation system that actually allows people who are older and shouldn't be dependent on cars to have alternative modes of transportation, and also like to just like live and be in a neighborhood with possibly friends and companionship around.
Imagine that. Yeah.
Your offspring.
Yeah, people you could.
This is interesting.
You are like some kind of like migrating bird that just like lets your children like off into the world and you never see them again.
Yeah. So the interesting thing here, though, is that the AARP has been extremely progressive on issues of aging in place and what it will take for California to address its issues with transportation network, built environment, et cetera. At the same time, I doubt that those views are mirrored much among their base. So it is very interesting that they are at this early juncture staking out a supportive position for SB 50. I'm curious whether or not that will engender some sort of backlash. I think that we've typically seen older, especially home-owning Californians are not fond of the type of political subversion of local control that is enshrined in SB 50. So we'll see.
As soon as this came out, I think we were all like, I know specific members of the AARP who I will be very upset about it.
Are we going to see like videos of people like burning their AARP cards?
I think so. Well, maybe we won't see them because they'll be like on tape or something. They will not be uploaded to YouTube.
But I should mention too that they threw their support behind Measure M and were a very vocal force and also had great support within their membership. But that's maybe a slightly different thing than building homes in, you know, on the end of your single family block. They helped get the transit there. Now let's get the housing there.
Let's talk about somewhat different kind of development. We've mentioned it before. Oceanwide Plaza downtown was, there was a work stoppage on it.
A different kind of housing development that's not really intended to house anybody.
People, yeah.
Let's turn it into like a retirement center, like the whole, like just seize all these buildings.
They're looking for ideas, it seems like. It's a $1 billion development, 500 condos, mixed use property right by Staples, incredibly valuable property. But and this a lot of this is according to the LA Times article by Roger Vincent about this. There was a work stoppage last month. It is still stoppaged.
Yep.
They said that it was going to be that work was going to continue in mid-February. Mid-February, I think, has passed by just about any definition. It doesn't look like it's going to get going anytime soon. And the main reason is, I think, like this kind of project validates everyone's worst fears about unchecked development in Los Angeles. Because apparently the developers of the project and lots of other downtown projects expected to sell their units to Chinese citizens looking for overseas investments.
Yeah.
But the Chinese government has changed their policy. They've made it more difficult for cash to leave the country. And that has affected condo sales in Los Angeles. Because like you were saying, these buildings are not supposed to house people. They are investment opportunities that exist in the physical world.
Yeah, I've heard them described as lockboxes in the sky, basically. So you have a ton of money. You don't want to put it in a Chinese bank or something. You want to put it in American real estate, which is perceived as a safe investment where you can leave money for a long period of time and then it will out-earn interest. You know, so you can get a return. But now that is not happening. And nobody was probably going to really be living in this building. But now nobody's definitely going to be living in there because it's not apparently going to be completed.
This article is so crazy. The headline is construction at massive Oceanwide Plaza in downtown LA remains stalled. There's so much unbelievably maddening stuff in it. They talk about since the policies in China have changed. One of the people working on the Greenland Metropolis development, a very similar type of building, says now Greenland has had to really start focusing on the local market, which includes. So now they are forced to potentially try and sell housing units to people that live in Southern California. It says it includes Southern Californians and some Chinese and Korean nationals who already have money in the U.S. That's the local market. People that were just got their money out earlier.
Yeah.
Someone from Greenland says, we get numerous calls a day from people looking for information, she said, including prospective buyers from Russia, the United Kingdom, and Mexico. Interest has also come from people who live in Orange and San Diego counties, considering a downtown LA pied-a-terre. So everyone except people, the 10 million people that that live in Los Angeles County.
So this is really interesting. I think this has been known for some time, long before the project actually started running into financial difficulties, long before the Chinese government started putting the brakes on the outflow of money from mainland China. It has been known that projects like these were Metropolis Oceanwide were being used as a mechanism for foreign investors to have something to invest in. So the sort of like make work building of real estate in order to give people that don't live here something to invest in. I think this is a tricky area of discussion because it has, in conversations I've seen before, tended towards what I would describe as like xenophobia.
Sure.
Particularly in Vancouver. I think this has been a major issue. But there is a real and valid concern with, from a political standpoint, if you are, say, like the mayor or city council of Los Angeles, how do you balance the fact that 25% of the active development in the county of Los Angeles is these major mega developments in downtown LA? And it's fundamentally being aimed at not people here who really need places to live.
Yes. I
don't think that that is to say we shouldn't allow these types of things, but it definitely doesn't seem like it should make up a quarter of what we're building, right?
Yeah, and it is doing active harm in terms of raising property values in the surrounding area. The Greenland building is selling units for more than $1,100 per square foot. That's $200 more than the average price per foot of a condo downtown. But I think you're right to point out the xenophobia. Feels like go to any major city on the West Coast and like you get in a cab or a rideshare from the airport and you start talking about like housing in the city and how it's like gotten expensive, and immediately it'll go to like, well, it's the Chinese. The Chinese are buying up all these properties and they're raising the price. Feels like how people used to talk about the Japanese in the 90s.
Yeah.
This like takeover.
And the conversation is frequently like, oh, well, if the Chinese were not a factor in real estate in LA, then there wouldn't be a problem, which I think is plainly xenophobic.
Absolutely not true. But obviously policy can be altered.
Yeah.
I mean, President Xi, that seems like, did the LA housing market a pretty big favor by just making it more difficult to make these investments in housing that is not designed to be lived in, but is making it harder for everyone else to live in these places. And that policy can be changed from the U.S. side as well and on the local side.
What I would say is I think that an undue amount of attention has been paid to developments like this by local politicians. I think that we have spent, as a city, as a region, we've spent a lot of time on this notion of economic development as being how do we build the biggest, shiniest, flashiest thing that we can in downtown? And if we are able to do that, I mean, this was especially true coming out of the recession at the beginning of the decade. If we're able to do that, that will mean that we are being successful economically as a city. And I think that that is a
global city.
I think that that is a fundamental misapprehension politically. And that is more troubling to me than the fact that developers from other countries want to build things here, is that politicians seem to think that if that happens, regardless of any of the outcomes for people living locally, that it will be a good thing. So the lack of nuance, I would say, politically is what I think needs to change.
Yeah, on not to both sides of it, but on both sides of it, where I think a lot of people also use these developments as an excuse to build nothing. who say, like, right, if you allow more building to happen in Los Angeles, it's just going to be these investment properties, mm-hmm, that will make it more expensive for everyone to live in the city. And it's not for locals. It's just for Chinese people.
Yeah.
I guess we're feeding into that now by talking about it.
Well, no, we have talked about that too on this program, where I feel like there is a strain of thought that LA doesn't need to build any more new housing units, because there are X amount of vacant units scattered around or whatever. And it's just a matter of, like, essentially forcibly redistributing population, which I don't think anybody on here at least thinks is appealing based on the discussions we've had in the past. But yeah, so there is definitely a middle ground between building nothing and building only things for an extremely wealthy elite who are not actually going to live there.
Yeah, may never see it.
And two things to add. I think there could be legislation tracking who's buying these that would create more transparency. Yes. Like other cities have, like New York and Miami. Seattle has been talking about it. I think Vancouver has something, uh-huh, but it was also very xenophobically worded. But I guess we also don't want people from, like, Orange County moving here. So that'd be the same. Would those count as, like, other foreign investments?
Orange curtain.
So that's one thing we could do. And then also in Denver, they had such a bad luxury glut that they did a kind of a rent discount program where they moved people into a lot of these towers in downtown Denver, people who couldn't have afforded them, and kind of, you know, subsidized the rent rates for all these people. And they housed, I think, 200 people just from, you know, in the first year or something like that. So that's another option on the table, provided that these units get finished.
Right. That's right. Let's talk about another new development. This one is going to cost $8 billion. It's going to take 16 years to complete. It's not a residential property. It is a water treatment project.
They should put housing on top of that. It would just be right there.
Yes. If you first you convince people to drink it, then you convince people to live inside it. This is, of course, the LA's wastewater treatment program right now provides basically none of the city's water. All the rainwater and wastewater goes into the ocean pretty much right now. But our new mayor, I think it's fair to say, he's really been
out there
on the scene the last couple of weeks, has made a pledge to recycle all of LA's wastewater by 2035 and use it to reduce the need for bringing in water from other places, which we do pretty much exclusively right now.
They do capture some of the stormwater already. You said that all the water goes to the ocean. And I would say we're talking about wastewater, not stormwater, but I just want to clarify that we do all that rain that we got, we do capture some of the storm water before it goes into the ocean. I just want to clarify.
I think recycling, it's so a lot of this is from an article by Bettina Boxall, who covers water very comprehensively for the LA Times. She says that recycling right now provides 2% of the city's water. And most of it does wash away because anything that goes into the sewer system, which is a ton of it, like goes out into the bay pretty much, I think,
that's stormwater. It's different than wastewater.
You should talk about this instead of me.
No, what I have to explain, but we have a very interesting system, but,
no, do explain. Explain to me.
Well, we have like the stormwater system, which is why you see when you are walking around the city, the little like Protect the Dolphins logos on all of our sewers.
Don't throw your
condoms down here, or, you know, and it's all that, you know, basically gets funneled in one way or another. Right. You were saying to the LA River, one of the other various storm drains that we have built to the ocean. We do some recycling of that storm water, or we do a capture, and, you know, what you want to do with it is, you know, it's not necessarily going to get recycled back into our, you know, the water we can use. But a lot of places, use their wastewater and completely, you know, recycle it and
wastewater.
Stick it, wastewater.
To get, like,
oh, sorry.
Technical on it. It's
wastewater is like your your sewage lines, which is a different. Yeah. So, and in some places, there people get quite a bit of their water that comes back out of the tap from, you know, recycled. You want to call it recycled, whatever you want to call it, the best word. So this would be super exciting if we could create our, you know, water independence by this date.
I feel like this is huge. And I'm really happy that Mayor Garcetti is pushing this as a priority. I think that normally, at least within the last couple of years, I think, you're very fair, Hayes, to say that this is our new mayor doing this, because Garcetti's MO has recently been extremely reactive, and he has to, I would say, be pushed far more than is reasonable for the sitting mayor of a major U.S. city just to respond to things that are going on. This actually seems like something that is a target that is well thought out and is not something that is just a response to things happening in the news or things that he's been actively pressured to do. It feels like something that an actual sitting person running a city would come up with. So that's good. I think it's a very good goal. I'm a little concerned because 2035 seems like the date that we append to things that we just are never going to do.
Everything's going to be done by 2035. It seems like every single date. But or if it's not done for the Olympics, I guess 2020 is the other big date.
But just getting the funding in place for this huge project, they want to take the Hyperion treatment plant on Dockweiler Beach and like really expand it. Hugely. I mean, it would just naturally take a while to have this happen. And it is something that if a mayor is like a figurehead, this is like the perfect thing for a politician to get out and advocate for, because it's not the easiest sell. People in LA
drinking your pee-pee,
yes,
you mean?
People in LA voted
drinking your poo-poo, I think is voted, more or less popular.
Voted against this in like 2000, 2001. There was an opportunity to have something like similar to this, and the people of LA said no.
They're like, no, gross.
It is a project that of course happens naturally. It's going like up into the cloud. Your pee-pee and poo-poo water is just going out of the ocean and then up into the she clouds comes. And then coming back down
as dirty grapple,
right, for us to drink later. So why, you know, like it's just recreating that natural
process. Yeah, we just speed it up a little bit. And like, it's not abnormal. This is done everywhere.
And Orange County does it. If Orange County,
we will let them move into downtown.
They were drinking their own pee already.
If they were doing it.
Things have definitely changed significantly in the past two decades. I mean, the recent very, very terrible drought is still very at the forefront of, I think, a lot of people's minds. I still kind of think of us as being in drought, even though we're technically not.
Technically not, but it'll probably be back next year.
Be back. But yeah, so I think that is that's pretty front and center in people's mind. I agree. I think this is something that it makes sense for Mayor Garcetti to use his political capital on. Also, I think that water issues in general, we just heard in the State of the State, Gavin Newsom talking about making significant adjustments to the Delta water tunnel plans that
that's right. He canceled something else. Yeah. Or maybe he didn't. We don't know.
He cut it in half. He said he didn't support it as proposed by Jerry Brown. This was a major unpopular thing that Jerry Brown was pushing forward, but possibly still needed. I think that just to say that we typically as Californians think of water as being a state level issue. And I think that there is a lot more that we can do at a local level that hasn't even been really broached. So the more active we can be as Angelenos in securing our water independence, in lowering the cost of actually supporting the people who live here, that is fantastic. We should definitely make that a priority.
Mm-hmm. And that can be done on an individual level, as we've talked about in the past, by people tearing out cement on
their
properties.
Keep it in the ground.
Letting water, the water.
But for water.
Go
also.
Into the ground.
And what is it called? Droppy, the mascot? Okay,
there's an, yeah, there. Well, I don't know the name of Droppy, but now there's, is it Leafy?
I think he is the Drop.
The Drop. And then
you
Leafy.
The drop.
There's Leafy, who's
these
the new tree one.
My nemesis. I
he does
hate
not
these mascots.
Like city mascots.
So, and I like, mascots are fine. These are so poorly designed.
They're so cute.
No, they look like they're made of felt.
They are made of felt.
Like a
that's
hasty school project.
Somebody went halfway
adorable.
To anthropomorphizing them and then just stopped.
Yes.
Obviously, you've never been hugged by
Leafy.
A felt. Yeah.
Oh,
Leafy.
I can't imagine what it like. I'd get like all this. I get like static shock.
But there are some.
To ground
there,
himself.
There's also some cool projects like in the valley with these like, you know, where we're going to actually trap the water in these underground aquifers that are there. They just need to be replenished. So there's a lot of cool ways that we can just keep our own water without flushing it away.
Speaking of the times, we want to talk about this fight that they're in now. It's pretty shocking. So they're owned by Tronc for like this horrible period. They finally get out from under Tronc. They get bought by local family doctor Patrick Soon-Shiong, and things seem to be going well. They're making a ton of hires there. They are hiring so many people. It's very exciting. And then the guild is engaging in this new contract negotiation with the LA Times, and the Times management brings them this intellectual property proposal that is so shockingly draconian and unfavorable to writers. It's almost unbelievable. This is all I can contribute as someone who's like worked in the entertainment industry. If you tried to bring an intellectual property proposal like this to like a Hollywood writer, you would like go to jail, basically. Like, it's so horrifying. It basically says that any content that an LA Times writer creates off the clock, if they decide to write a novel, if they decide to write a book based on their reporting, all of it is owned by the LA Times.
Yeah.
All the characters, all the representations of the reporter in the media.
Essentially anything that the reporter learns about anything as a byproduct of having been employed at the LA Times.
Yes.
They own in perpetuity any intellectual property that comes out of that.
And the LA Times reporters have created some both hugely commercially successful in the form of Michael Connelly, who created Bosch while he was a Times crime reporter, and maybe the best LA book of the last 20 years. Jill Leavy was a LA Times reporter, and she wrote Ghetto Side, an unbelievable book. Under these intellectual property rules, I would say not only would the LA Times own them, but they probably would just never happen. There's no incentive to create something like that if you have no ownership of it. Oh, and also Steve Lopez,
the soloist,
was
the
played
soloist.
By Robert Downey Jr. In The Soloist.
Kickstarting Robert Downey Jr.'s revival and leading to
whole Marvel universe.
If Iron Man wasn't a success, then
oh, God,
would ever
absolutely.
Happen.
This would never have happened.
So the LA Times is torpedoing Los Angeles's entertainment economy right now. I think it's fair to say. No, but this is interesting to me because I always thought we are. I think we've been very happy that the Times journalists were rescued from Tronc. It is important to note that Pat Soon-Shiong, Dr. Pat, was part of Tronc. It like remains one of their largest shareholders.
That's
right. Always struck me as sort of being like if you were like, oh, we're no longer owned by like the Legion of Doom. Now it's like Solomon Grundy. has sole ownership of us or whatever. It's kind of interesting.
Yes, it is interesting. I think he was seen as sort of an agitator from the inside.
Right.
He and Michael Farrow, the CEO, were like constantly at a war for supremacy, much like often happens at the Legion of Doom.
But this actually, I think, kind of, it'll be interesting to see how this gets resolved. Of course, the LA Times journalists have been in union negotiations, I think, are still ongoing. Is that, this is part of that.
Yeah, this is part of that. Yes.
They've been in protracted bargaining negotiations, trying to get fair terms for the union membership. But I think it kind of tracks with what we know about Soon Shiong in terms of, he's been very bullish on the opportunity to create new profit centers yep. within the existing journalism model. So we're talking about The Soloist. We're talking about Ghetto Side. We're talking about
Dirty John,
major intellectual.
Don't laugh. Giant.
No,
huge
I know.
Property.
I was a fan.
Run basically the entire circuit of media.
It's been
and is
it's,
back
it's,
probably
it's taken at, every format at this
probably
point.
Back at a podcast yes. about how the original podcast was made at this point. But yeah. So I think it scans with what we know about Dr. Pat that he considers these intellectual property suites as one of the biggest growth areas that the Times could see.
Worth pointing out, that is how he made his money in the medical field, is okay. basically being very aggressive about copywriting.
Like
drug and medical techniques.
Yeah.
As you can hear me hitting the wall on my medical knowledge. But basically, that's how he became a billionaire,
yeah.
is owning
right.
the rights.
Is that not common
things.
For doctors?
But he, so that's, I think the most generous version of what's happening is the negotiators, the people coming in to handle this, don't understand how it works
yeah.
for content creators.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a little different than it is for in medicine or technology patents and things
yeah.
like that. Like, you just can't claim ownership of these things outright. And I think, like, there is some kind of middle ground where the LA Times should be able to provide basically seed opportunities mm-hmm. for projects like Dirty John. I wasn't crazy about it. I don't think it's like the most worthwhile thing, but they, you know, provided the venue and the opportunity for Christopher Gofford to like get that, publish that story across 6 front pages and like really get it off the ground and like be able to make some money off that afterwards.
Sure.
But this like total and complete control over the product and how much the author gets and making it impossible for anyone to go off and write their own book.
And it's totally at odds with the way that other major newspapers handle this. I think that there is a conventional wisdom within the newspaper industry, part of probably the conventional wisdom that Soon Shiong sees himself as shaking up. But I think that the conventional wisdom there is that if you have people like Steve Lopez, who everybody becomes familiar with, becomes sort of a household name when there's a major Hollywood movie that is made based on his reporting at the Times, that is an item of prestige for the newspaper itself. That
absolutely.
The newspaper has a vested interest in their journalists doing these big, impressive works, even though they're not claiming all financial ownership of it, that it actually redounds benefit to them in terms of people saying, that's where Steve Lopez works. That's mm-hmm. where, you mm-hmm. know, et
yep.
cetera. That's what they get out of it, basically. And if those stop happening, then it will look bad for the LA Times because they don't have these big name journalists.
And I think that's it's counterproductive because these projects,
right.
they won't own these projects. The projects will not happen.
Yeah,
like no
exactly.
one will.
You don't feel the need to do cool things.
There's no incentive to go do
yeah.
anything cool, which like a lot of like present day LA Times journalists are doing. I think James Quealy is a crime novelist. He's a crime reporter.
Yep.
Juliet Lapidos, I think she used to be an editor at the LA Times and just quit to write like a huge novel. They have some great writers there
yeah.
with like books will come out if they give them the opportunity to own these properties. And I'm not sure what we can do, but I think if you follow the LA Times Guild account, then they'll give you updates on if there's petitions to be signed, like protests to be joined and stuff, because I think this is kind of an important thing. Anything else this week? That's it. We'll be back next week. But we have to get sick again. Everyone has to. This is unsustainable that we're all
far too peppy this
morning. We're all healthy. See you next week on LA Podcast. Bye bye.